Okay, so now we're actually starting the podcast.
Sure.
I feel nervous to start it because you always make fun of me.
Welcome to Pop Culture Parsha,
where we irreverently discuss reverent texts.
I think we're getting better at that. But did you hear that I took a huge pause between pop culture and Parsha because it's really hard to say all together?
We can edit it out in post. Yeah. I was listening to a podcast today and they speak so quickly to each other. I was like, are they editing out or are they just like really good at podcasting?
So I was listening back to ours when it first dropped because I just wanted to see what it was, and I'm incredibly vain. And my giggling is so weird in like 1.2 speed that I had to slow it back down to regular because I was like, and I was like, oh, I was like, into that. It was too much. So
yeah, I get that.
You know? Okay. So this week's Parsha.
No.
Oh, our pop culture moment.
Yeah, we're literally just talking about it.
I have the memory of a goldfish.
Okay, this week,
who are you?
I am the Berenstain Bears conspiracy.
Oh, are you Berenstain or Berenstain?
Berenstain.
Okay, cool.
I can't remember now which way the conspiracy went.
Everyone thinks it's Berenstain, but it's Berenstain.
Yeah.
Yeah. This week I am Sally Field's Oscar acceptance speech.
Nice.
I'm like, you like me. You really like me. I've been thinking about that. I don't know, like, all week. It's just been in my head on repeat. I watched it 3 times on YouTube.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
So this week's Parsha is Lech Lecha.
Okay.
And I think I'm doing the Parsha summary, so I'm now pulling up my Al HaTorah. Do you want to summarize
it? Here's the thing. You know we have a Parsha podcast that we just set up and sat down to record, and you
because
didn't
I got distracted because I got distracted because we were doing.
And here's the thing: you're going to edit this out, so no one knows how disorganized you just were.
Wow, we were trying to deal with the sound. It's fine, true. I'll leave all of this in. This week's Parsha. Lech Lecha.
Lech Lecha.
God says to Avram, "Go forth." Very defining Parsha, this one. A lot happens. Avram does leave. He goes out. He takes his wife and his brother, his wife Sarai and his brother Samlot and all their stuff. And they do some traveling and he builds an altar. Does he build an altar? He pitches a tent.
Yeah, he does an altar.
And then there's a famine. So he goes down to Egypt. And then for the first time, Avram pretends his wife is his sister.
Yeah.
To save himself. Classic.
Classic Schmosby.
I mean, yeah, classic classic Genesis, honestly. Yeah. It's not the last time. Yep. It is the first time, but it's not the last time. Pharaoh takes Sarai because she's beautiful and, as far as he knows, single. Yeah. And then the Lord afflicts Pharaoh again, not for the first time, but not for the last time. And then he finds out that Sarai is Avram's wife and not his sister. And then they go to the Negev, and Lot and, Avram part ways because there's not enough space in the Negev for the two of them. And so Lot goes and lives in
this
Sodom.
Negev ain't big enough for the both of us. Like that.
Exactly like that. I think that is verbatim what that conversation was like. And then there's some wars.
Yeah, there's wars.
With lots of kings. There are all these kings in the area and they're all fighting each other.
Yeah.
And Avram goes in to rescue Lot and his possessions. A lot happens in here. There's a lot of men stuff.
Well, there's also like the Brit Ben Habitarim this week, which we will not get into, but it's absolutely bonkers of like Avram cutting up these different animals into two and then like him and God like passing through it, and that is like some weird red carpet of
right,
sorts.
Right, yeah. A
red gala. The Met Gala, but it's just carcasses.
Okay, and then we finally get to Genesis 16. Sarai is barren. She has a maidservant whose name is Hagar. Sarai is like, look, if I can't have children, maybe you can have children with Hagar. And so Avram takes Hagar, and then she gets pregnant, and then it says her mistress was lowered in her esteem. Unclear who those pronouns are referring to, right?
Hug her mistress.
It says, like, she was lowered in her eyes.
Right, yeah.
So Rai kicks Hagar out because she's jealous that Hagar got pregnant. And then while Hagar is in the wilderness, an angel comes to her and says, go back to your mistress. And then she's told that she'll have a son who has lots of offspring as well. And so Ishmael is born. And then finally, like, God appears to Avram and names himself, and God gives him this prophecy. He renames Abraham, he renames Sarai to Sarah, and then they circumcise themselves and all the men in their household and Ishmael, who is 13.
Like, a jam-packed from start to end parsha. Like, there's not a moment's notice, right?
I mean, like, all of the ones in Bereshit are kind of like that.
Yeah, Vayera as well. We were discussing it the other day. Like, that's crazy. But anyway, that's for next week.
That's next week.
So Lech Lecha, again, like, I'm going to say, I feel like I have to defend my choice of pop culture that I chose this week, because it was my week to choose. One of the parts that is very overlooked in this week's parasha, because I feel like it's not as big as, like, circumcision. It gets lost because usually all of the different Divrei Torah are about circumcision or about this idea of Lech Lecha and what does it mean to go out from your house. And all of those things. And something that's, like, nestled in the middle is this really interesting, like, dynamic that gets set up between Sarai and Hagar and Avram, which is basically just, like, what does their three-parent household look like? What is the dynamics between these two women? And so that is why I chose the film Stepmom this week. Or if I was Stepmom. If I was an American, it's dumb.
You're not getting anything out of me. Whatever. I talk how I talk, okay?
Stepmom. Anyway, Stepmom. We said 1998. Susan Sarandon and Julia Roberts and Ed Harris, who plays the husband. Okay, I'm going to start before I even tell you what this is. Julia Roberts is at the height of her career. The height, mamash. Like, she is the it girl. And they want to tell me that Ed Harris is who she chooses to be with in this movie? You think Ed Harris can pull Julia Roberts? If you don't know who these people are, because one of my friends told me last week, I don't know the celebrities you're talking about. Leora, Google it. Google Ed Harris. Google Julia Roberts 1998.
Do you love Ed Harris? Because you also just made me watch The Truman Show.
I thought of The Truman Show because he was in this movie.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
But I'm also always thinking about The Truman Show.
You're right. I also thought that she's like she's a beautiful, successful gorgeous photographer. And he, I mean, okay, his proposal to her is like pretty cute.
Okay, but like,
but there's no evidence for why the two of them are in love.
Not a bit. Like, we arrive a year into their relationship, so we just have to like trust them. But I don't trust it because it makes no sense in my head. There's also like, there's like 20 years between them.
Yeah.
But anyway, Susan Sarandon, Julia Roberts. Susan Sarandon is the mother of these two children. One of them is Jenna Malone from The Hunger Games. One of them is the older brother, the brother in the original movie of A Series of Unfortunate Events.
Oh,
the
yeah.
The one with Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
And so Susan Sarandon's their mother. Julia Roberts is their like father's girlfriend, who then is going to be their stepmother eventually. And it's just about this dynamic of like, Susan Sarandon doesn't like Julia Roberts' approach. Julia Roberts feels like she's like, I don't know, encroaching on this family, doesn't really have any say, and wants a relationship with these kids, but these kids are really like adamantly against it type thing. And so there's lots of screaming and fighting and teenage girl stuff going on as well. So I think it's a great movie. So that's a really good movie.
Yeah, it was an enjoyable movie to watch. I mean, I have some thoughts.
Thing we got a podcast then.
I do think it's really interesting that you zoomed in, because I was like doing some reading and some listening about this parsha, and yeah, there is so much going on. And so, were you always interested in this story of Hagar, or at what point did like this become like the central part of Lech Lecha for you?
Well, we studied Sefer Bereshit really in depth last year, and this was a story that really struck a chord for some reason. also because we see this dynamic crop up again later, right? Like, by the time we get to Rachel and Leah and Bilhah and Zilpah, and even then it's more complicated because there's not really that antagonism between, like, the sisters and their maidservants. It's, like, the sisters and, like, it's between Rachel and Leah is, like, the main antagonism.
Right.
But I think there's just so much about this part of, like, what does it tell us about Sarai's character, right? Hagar doesn't get cast out at this point. She runs away because she's treated like absolute crap by Sarai.
Right.
I can read the English of the text, but it says, verse 6, Sarai treated her harshly and she ran away from her. And so,
right, and there's, like, a lot of conversation about whether or not, like, amongst the commentators, about whether or not what Hagar did was bad enough to deserve that punishment. Yeah. But there is also, I can't remember who suggested it, that this was, like, a common thing in the ancient Near East, and that once somebody becomes a wife in that way, right, like, what we understand as becoming a wife is different. Like, it used to be, like, when you slept with someone, like, okay, yeah, now you're married. And so once she became Avram's wife, that Hagar should have been equal in status to Sarai. But one of the commentators says that all Sarai does is continue treating Hagar like a servant, but yeah, that's enough, that it is warranted that she kicks, well, that, no, wait, now I've lost my train.
No, I get what you mean. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. So, yeah, so you have this question, firstly, of, you know, what is Sarai doing that's so harsh? And, again, does it warrant, is it okay that she's doing it? And I think that traditionally we understand the story as, like, well, Sarai is one of the good guys, and Hagar is from Egypt, who we know later on is the bad guys. Even a couple of, what is it, like, two prakim before, Egypt's already the bad guys, right? Like, Sarai is kidnapped by the pharaoh. And so we have that dynamic already, like, this big dynamic at play. And we see it on a microcosm where traditionally they're both set up as very much like a hero and a villain-ish.
Right.
And then, but we see the opposite happen, where, like, Hagar is victimized here. One of my notes I wrote down when I was watching the movie is, if the Torah was, like, invested or concerned about the minutiae of their everyday life, do you think we would have seen, like, scenes or images of Sarai as, like, a third parent to
Ishmael?
To Ishmael. And, like, that, because we don't see that. That's something that the movie has that we don't have, is that we see both mothers' relationships with their children in a way.
Right.
Or with these children. And I just feel like what it would look like. First of all, what was Sarai thinking? Of, because she says, like, she will have a child and it'll be a child for me, right?
Right.
She says, perhaps I will have a son through her. Does she think that Hagar is going to just give up, like, custody of her child?
Right. There are so many details. And I think, like, this it obviously is a theme throughout the Torah of, like, what the details that are left out are so confusing, right? In the next parsha, two parshas from now, when Ishmael laughs, and that's what causes, spoiler alert, that's what causes Sarai to be, when she has Yitzchak, in the next parsha, yes, I've read them all, I promise, in the next parsha, and so all he does is laugh, and she's like, that's enough, and we don't have any other information about whether or not he's a good kid or not.
Yeah.
Only that there's this underlying tension of, obviously, she thinks it'll be okay with her. And I bet that, like, Susan Sarandon and Ed Harris, when they got divorced, Susan Sarandon was probably like, yeah, it'll be fine if he dates someone else. But then when you, like, see that in action, that's when you're...
Well, there's also the interesting idea, like, and I think that, again, okay, I'm going to say now spoilers for this film if you haven't seen it, but also this film was released, like, over 20 years ago, so at this point, you, like, it's your fault you haven't seen it, you know what I mean? You have this dynamic that the film brings in that Susan Sarandon is dying, right, and that she is, like, forcibly about to have to give up, in a sense, her kids to this stepmother, because she knows, like, logically, she knows these kids need someone in their life after me, because my husband is Ed Harris, and all we've seen him do is be bald and angry.
Right.
so Susan Sarandon's in this place where, like, she has to give custody of her children, in a sense, to this other woman she doesn't like. And she doesn't want to do that. Whereas Sarai in this case is, like, you know, trying to take a child from... I don't know why I've superimposed Sarai onto Susan Sarandon. Maybe it's the alliteration, but...
Yeah.
Like, who... Like, I don't think there is a clear-cut who is who, like, comparison, right?
No, because... Like, Julia Roberts is pretty... Well, I think, yeah, it's just different because Julia Roberts thinks that she's kind of like... At one point in the movie, she's kind of like, I never thought I would have kids.
Yeah. She's the Sarai of the story.
Yeah. But Susan Sarandon is like, stay-at-home mom. Yeah. Like, this was... It seems like this is what she wanted. Okay. Also, how rich are they in that movie?
Very.
Because they have a massive house and he has an apartment...
In the city. Well, he's like a lawyer.
And they do horseback riding.
That's how you know they're rich. That's it. That's yeah. The ticket, that one right there.
Okay, I just want to say, if you haven't watched this movie, it is just like such a classic 90s movie. Yeah. I wrote down all of the things that like make it a 90s movie. Okay, number one starts out with a radio intro. Like somebody waking up to the sound of the radio. And then... There's the sitting on the counter. I just feel like that's so 90s in my mind. And, like, them drinking wine, like, and her being like, guess I'm going to have to open another bottle. I just feel like you don't see that as much now.
I forgot they stopped drinking wine in movies after 1999.
But I feel like,
right.
I don't know, I was just like, oh, my God, what are they, alcoholics? Yeah. Like, the way they talk about alcohol. There's a photo shoot. Just, like, I don't, like, I'm thinking of, like.
Oh, with the photo shoot? You become painfully aware that, like, Julia Roberts has never seen a camera in her life for some reason. She's, like, holding the camera still the entire time and just looking through it. There's no dynamic movement. Like,
and then she's always like, changing. We got the shot.
Yeah.
Has any photographer ever said that? Like,
you stood in the exact same spot, held the camera in the same place the whole time, taken, like, 5 fake photos and called it a day.
Okay, and she must be so good at Photoshop to Photoshop that suit on that little man. I'm like, that would not... Like, I am sure that they dressed him up in that suit to take that photo.
100%.
Okay, here are my other 90s movie things.
Because I have my own 90s reasons, but I'll let you go first.
Central Park Boats.
100%, yes.
A hairbrush song session.
Mm-hmm. Or just like, a musical number, a song that they try and make, like, the theme of the movie. You know, it's, like, very, like, My Best Friend's Wedding, very Ferris Bueller, like...
Right.
Yeah, they do Ain't No Mountain High Enough in this one.
Great song.
Oh, amazing song.
And then the last thing I wrote down was kids dressed up as Native Americans.
That's on my list,
slash
too.
Cultural appropriation. Multiple times. He's wearing a headdress after the birthday party, and then they have the full pilgrim Thanksgiving thing.
So my list of things that make it 90s is the list of things that are problematic in the film that would get canceled today.
Nice.
Being that she sets her soon-to-be stepdaughter up on a fake date with a fully grown male model, and her stepdaughter is in middle school.
Yeah.
And then this fully grown man with long hair kisses what I assume just is on a 12-year-old on the cheek, but still, it's like weird. They use the R word like twice. I know that because captions were on and I heard it. In the same scene with like, what R word? We can't get recorded saying it.
Oh
yeah, wow, what were you thinking?
I have no idea. That's why I was like, what R word are you talking about?
Valerie is such an edelmadel that she doesn't even know slur. Also, again, like, Native American outfits, teaching again your 11-year-old stepdaughter what snow blowing is. I don't even know what snow blowing
did you
is.
Look
I
it just, up
no I was scared
I didn't look it up either. Can I say, I'm going to cut this out.
Oh my God, I hate it. Why would Julia Roberts say that to an 11-year-old?
She must have got paid so much to do this movie. I would be like, absolutely not. Thankfully, they didn't have the internet at that time. Oh my God,
that's horrible. Anyway, what I was going to say before you gave me that disgusting information, I think that we should cut out you telling, saying what it is, like, keep in our reaction.
Yes. okay, well, sorry, what were you going to say?
So it's very musically similar to the first two Harry Potter movies. Like, there's Christmas scenes and there's, like, this snow music, and it's very similar. The reason it is similar, they share both a director and a composer. John Williams composed the music for this film, and Chris Columbus directed it.
Wow.
And I just was noticed, like, whenever it was a Christmas snow scene, and I was like, this sounds like Harry's this man has, like, one overture that he just plays all the time and, like, calls it a day.
On the subject of, like, costumes and the kids dressing up, that is an excellent Elvis costume that she wears.
Oh, amazing.
Great Elvis costume. Totally wrong for that age. Like, I feel like no girl, like, middle school girl would dress up as Elvis.
That should make her quirky.
But she's not really quirky.
Yeah, she's not.
She rides horses.
Yeah.
She has riding lessons at 6:30 in the morning.
Yeah. Also, like, you know what else is really 90s? Back to that, just for one sec. The son is obsessed with magic. I feel like that's the biggest trope of, like, I don't know what to do with this young child in a movie, so I'm going to make him obsessed with magic and call it a day.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. I was like, and just, like, the idea, when she was like, when you were born, all the nurses thought you looked like you were wearing a cape. I was like, why? He's not going to be a magician. Like, nobody grows up to be a famous magician.
Tell that to David Blaine.
I will tell it straight to his face. Tell that to
Harry Houdini.
Okay, Harry Houdini, fine.
Tell that to...
Penn and Teller.
Oh, Penn and Teller.
Anyway, okay. Definitely, I feel like having a child in a movie is always rough. Like, I just feel like that is, like, a tough age to find, like, a good actor. I feel like they lay it on really thick with him as the younger sibling. Like, there's a lot of younger sibling energy.
Jenna Malone is fantastic in it.
Yeah.
She must be, like, 13, 14. She's wonderful.
Yeah, she's pretty good.
Yeah.
Actually, I think some of the best acting in the movie comes from her. Oh, also, the getting a puppy was, like, kind of a weird, right? They get a puppy.
And then you never see it again.
No, you do actually see it again. Oh, yeah. It's there at the Christmas scene at the end, which I appreciated. The puppy is in the next, like, several scenes. There's a puppy. But then there is, like, a whole chunk of the movie where the puppy is just nowhere to be found. And I also feel like that's, like, a missed comedic opportunity of, like, Julia Roberts gets them a puppy and then, like, and then it's just smooth sailing. Like, besides the girl being, like, a jerk about it.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I didn't spend so much time thinking about the puppy.
What do you think Sarai... Do you think Sarai at any point tries to bond with Ishmael? Like, what do you think the equivalent of getting those kids a puppy is?
Hey buddy, I got you this new bow and arrow set.
She's like, do you want to sing My Yiddy Doo together?
There's some fresh challah in my tent if you want to... make some toast. I don't know, like, what?
I made you a lentil stew.
Oh, that's a few parts.
Okay, do you think that Hagar ever pulled something like the Pearl Jam ticket thing?
Oh, interesting. So the Pearl Jam ticket, Julia Roberts asked Susan Sarandon if she could take the daughter
to a
Pearl Jam concert. And Susan Sarandon's like, you want to take a 12-year-old girl to a concert on a school night? Like, that's insane. And then she buys her tickets for that concert and they go together.
Yeah. And also, she comes in, this is, like, after they're, like, singing together in the car, they have this, like, sweet bonding moment, singing Ain't No Mountain High Enough, and the little girl, like, puts on Julia Roberts' lipstick, which is a lovely neutral color, and then she walks in and the mother's like, oh, I don't think I've seen anybody but streetwalkers wear that shade. And I was like, that is just, like, the whole scene is, like, so dark.
Well, that's also, like, it brings me to a point that I wanted to make, which was, there's this line in the movie where I think the daughter's name is Anna. She says, Valerie just rolled her eyes.
She doesn't know either.
Where she says to Susan Sarandon, she says, if you want me to, I'll hate her. And you see it, like, wash over Susan Sarandon's face that, like, she's putting her kids in this really awkward position where they like Sarai. And so in my head, I'm like, I wonder if there's this point where Ishmael's just a kid growing up in a house. It's really hard sometimes to hate a kid.
Right.
Right? And Sarai, if she's nice to him because, like, you know, in her eyes, this is sort of her son too. But Ishmael probably has allegiances to his mother.
For sure.
And we only see, like, later on, like, literally the only interaction we see between Ishmael and Sarai is, like, Sarai seeing him do something and then kick him out.
Add on to that, like, a family dynamic and that, like, those were, like, the only people you knew in the world.
Yeah.
And I think similar to Ed Harris, Avram is just, like, really absent in this narrative. Like, he's there, obviously. He impregnates Hagar. And then he basically, like, goes along with whatever Sarai said.
It's not just that he's, like, absent and, like, does what Sarai says. He says, she's your maid, do what you want. Right? So he's like, I don't care. Like,
right.
What do I care about two women catfighting in a tent next to mine? Like, shut up and just deal with it. I don't know, he's not there. And then he just casts, and then he doesn't even cast them out. Hagar runs away. Do you think he, like, notices she's missing at all?
I have no idea, but I did look on Al HaTorah. They have alhatorah.org. Highly recommend it as a Torah resource. They have a section for art in Tanakh, or, like, depictions of the Parsha in art. And so the two scenes that they have for this are one of Sarai banishing Hagar, and it's, like, they're standing outside of a house, which is crazy, but it's, like, Avram is, like, in the background, kind of, like, in the doorway of the house. And it's, like, Sarai sending out Hagar. And then the other scene is Hagar coming back with, like, an angel with her. And Avram, like, welcoming her back. And then Sarai is in the background. Which I think are both, like, really interesting depictions of... Yeah, and it's unclear if Hagar... Isn't it unclear in the text if Hagar actually runs away because Sarai says something, or if just because she knows that Sarai is upset?
Sarai treats her harshly, and she ran away from her.
Right.
And then Hagar is found by this angel in the wilderness. The angel tells her to go back, and it says, like, go back to her mistress, submit to her harsh treatment. God will increase your offspring. There'll be too many to count. That you will have a son and you'll call him Yishmael, and because God has heard about your suffering.
This is the other thing the commentators think, is that some of them think that the way that Sarai treated her harshly was she made her work so hard that she miscarried. And so then in this place where they're like, behold, you are with child, they're saying that, like, God is promising her that she'll have a son, like, that she'll have another child if she goes back. But then it's also interesting because she names God, and we know from, right, she says, you are El Roy.
Right. Which is also, like, I don't know what redneck names sound like in America, but bogan names in Australia, like Elroy, sounds like like, it sounds like a hillbilly, like, Elroy, you come here, like,
yeah, it really does. But it's interesting because we know the power of naming things from Bereshit, that Adam names all of the creatures, and that's whatever. So,
but also that's the thing, speaking about naming things and, like, the power that it sort of holds, is that this angel tells her that her son's name will be Ishmael. But then when they have the baby, it says that Avram names the child Yishmael. And so it's just, like, I guess reestablishing maybe the power dynamic between the two after she comes back and the baby's born, like, even though God has decreed what his name will be. What I was going to say is that it doesn't say this son, it says Beno, his son.
Yeah.
He named his son. And so I think what's even more interesting is that Sarai set up this whole dynamic that Hagar would have a child for Sarai and Avram. I'll have a son born through her.
Mm.
And we get the end of the parak, and Avram still at this point, and Hagar have this son. Hagar bears the child, Avram names the child, and Sarai's name is nowhere to be mentioned.
That's
Sarai's
true.
Name isn't mentioned for, like, a bunch of psukim at that point.
Well, until he renames her.
Yeah, and then, like, is named... She's not even in the first part. Yeah, she's not in the first part of the next parak. And only appears sort of, like...
15 prakim later.
Sukim. Yeah. So it's, like, where... Like, is she mourning the loss of this child she thought she was going to have? Like, what... What is happening?
Is Sarai mourning?
Yeah.
Right, it's interesting to, like... The things that we learn about Ishmael, like, the angel says, he shall be a wild ass of a man, his hand against everyone and everyone's hand against him.
Yeah.
Which then, I guess, like, maybe illustrates to us later why Sarai kicks Ishmael out.
Like, this wild ass of a man. Well,
Right. So I wonder, like, in that prophecy, if, like, that's when it changes from being Sarai's son to being Hagar's son. Right? Like, is that the dividing line? The angel
coming and saying.
Right. Or maybe, yeah, because they're like, he'll be a wild ass of a man, so he's not going to be the father of Israel.
Or is it also just, like, the reason that Sarai is not the mother is because of just that's how human interaction works. Of she's, I'm going
to
say, she's
just literally not his mother.
She's not his mother. She's a bitch to his birth mother. And she's set herself up in this way that, like, Hagar might try and keep him away from her. You know what I mean? So she's sure. just not there.
Yeah, it makes sense. Right. Right, and we don't get any of that conflict. Like, it's just that Ishmael is born, and the next time we hear about Hagar and Ishmael is when Sarai kicks them out.
Yeah. Well, no, we hear that Ishmael gets circumcised, and then we hear Hagar and him get kicked out.
Right, so he's Avram's son enough.
Yeah, that he has to get circumcised.
Wow. And then what's that? Do you think that, like, Yitzhak grows up knowing that he has a half-brother?
Well, I think Mepharshim say that, like, that's why Sarai kicks him out, because of, like, this unruly influence that he could have over Yitzhak.
Right. But then I guess what I'm saying is, like, does Avram, like, is it clear to Yitzhak, like, if Yitzhak is just born?
Oh, interesting.
And so does Yitzhak know that all of this happens before he's born? Like, how
you
much?
You gotta assume that, like, there's not much going on in this society. Like, they don't have lots of stories.
Right.
And so,
well, probably that he becomes, like, a cautionary tale. Like, yeah. Sarai is, like, don't end up, like, that crazy Ishmael.
Well, it's like you see, like, parents when they're like, you had a sibling, but they didn't eat their vegetables, and then they got arrested. So it was like that, but it was true.
Wow. What a parenting technique. Did you ever try to tell your brother that he was adopted or anything?
Oh, my God, no. Okay. My brother... My brother's 2.5 years older than me.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't really...
Yeah, I know, because you have big younger sibling energy.
You have younger sibling energy.
Too bad I said it on the podcast first, so I win.
I was going to bring it up before. I could have sworn I mentioned it enough, but maybe I
gave you an opening. I said younger sibling energy.
I know. And in my head was like, have I mentioned this before? I can't keep bringing this up. It's the one thing I've got is that I say this about you. Anyway, my brother's 2.5 years older than me. In terms of, like, when we were younger, like, no one really knew who he looked like. My mom was like, he has your father's build, but no one's face. Like, he has, like, the same, like, build as my dad did. I look a lot like my dad, I've always been told. And so it's, like, very clear. You can see I'm related to the family.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother's got, like, lighter hair than my parents and I have, and, like, all of that stuff. So it's like, my brother always told me I was adopted. And then when I was 10, we came to Israel for the first time on, like, a family holiday. And my brother somehow started this story that still scars me to this day. I don't even know how he came up. It's so stupid. There's no way I can believe it. My brother told me I was adopted. Like, they were in Israel, like, 10 years ago before this trip. And they were going down the highway and they found a deformed camel on the side of the road that was so deformed it looked like a human. And had been, like, neglected and left for dead by its camel family. And my family took pity on this camel, deformed camel that looked like a human, that they took it in. And that was me. And when I tell you that, like, I'm really about to cry talking about it right now, because it was so ridiculous. But he would always tell me this. And I'm like, I'm not a camel. I'm not. And, wow. Like,
this is younger sibling energy. Like, you're still upset about something he told you.
So stupid. And then one time, we were, like, in the family room going through all of these boxes and stuff. This is after a lifetime of my brother just always randomly telling me I'm adopted.
And that you're a camel.
That was always in and out, because, like, none of us spoke about that camel thing for, like, I'd say 15 years. And then, like, last year I was like, do you remember you used to say this, like, whacked thing to me? And, like, whatever. Wow. He thought it was hilarious still.
It's pretty funny. But it's, like, a good story.
So stupid. Like,
An older sibling, I appreciate that level of torture. Dumb.
But we were sitting on, like, the couch sorting through this old stuff, that, like, box of stuff my mom had, and I saw a piece of paper, and it said huge letters up the top, adoption, and it said Shoshana, middle name redacted, Gottlieb, and my heart, and I was, like, literally 18 or 19, my heart dropped. I, like, started having a panic attack, and then I read further, like, and this was all happening in the space of like maybe 3 seconds of like me, I'm like, oh my god, I'm adopted, everything I know is a lie. I read further down, it's like Shoshana Gottlieb adoption has adopted a bear from like this like the RSPCA drive, and like I almost passed away, and my family was on the couch like piecing together what had happened, because like I stopped breathing, and that's what they talk about now. Is it like, remember that time you found an adoption certificate and you thought you were adopted? And I was like, remember that time I thought my entire life was a lie? Yeah, I remember that. Wow. Thank you. What about you? Did you tell your younger brother that you, after we unpacked my trauma, did you ever tell your younger brother that he was adopted?
I'm sure that I did. But here's what I'll say is that a lot of people, when my brother was like in kindergarten, I guess my mom would and my brother would go to like things that normally your family would go to, but it would just be the two of them, so people like didn't know that my dad or I existed. Anyway, I'm sorry. I'm sure that there's something out there.
I shared trauma this week, which means you have to share trauma next week.
Okay, I'll come up with something.
Okay.
I'll ask my... here's what I'll do. I'll make you all a promise that I will ask my brother what memories he has of me torturing him.
That's fair.
Okay, so who are we casting?
Wait, I have one last point to make. Yeah. And I think the main difference for me about this movie and versus the Parsha is that... let me read my notes again. Is that the movie is about, like, these women's relationship to the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that's the whole thing. It's, like, how do they exist? Like, how do they both have enough motherly love for these children? And what does it mean for the other one's motherly love? Whereas the Parsha is less about, like, how am I going to feel about this child? And what is our relationship going to be like? And it's very much about what power does having this child bring to our wider lives. It's about like the power dynamic of what holding that child and like mothering that child means.
Right, there's kind of like a King Solomon vibe of like the mothers end up ultimately and stepmom end up being friends because like that's what they both want, what's better for the kids.
They realize it's just about, it's about like, they say it at the end, it's like, they're both going to learn from us and they're both going to like have us in their lives for however long, and all we can do is like the best for them, which is like, you know, the kitschy end of a movie, and we don't often see a lot of that more romantic stuff or like, you know, like emotional stuff in the Torah. But I think it's just very interesting, like, in one hand it's like what's best for these kids and what do we think is best for these kids, and on the other hand it's what does this child turn me into in terms of my husband and our society.
Right, it's like a big question, I think, about, at least for me, about having children is like, is having children just like narcissism or, I don't know, I often think it's like, to think that like I could be a parent is just like the biggest act of hubris. Like, and so like it is interesting. It's like, like this idea that Avram is being told like you will be the father of like nations. And also crazy that then he has one son. I mean, he has two, but the Israelite nation comes from one son of his, as like, you know, it's like just the same amount of expectation that's then put on Yitzhak that like then he's going to be like have many children. I feel like, and I think like it's probably easier in the Tanakh, like where Sarai and Hagar are, because there's no actual human that they're putting these expectations on. Like there's no baby yet.
Yeah.
And whereas in Stepmom, these are two like living, breathing children that then they have to, you know, fictional, but that then they are like wanting the best for. And so like they can each see like what the daughter is interested in, what the son is interested in, which is only magic and hiding in a cabinet.
His entire personality is rambunctious. Like, so I feel like, if the child plays no part in the movie, like she could have been an only child. She didn't need a younger brother obsessed with magic. He added nothing to that story.
Yeah. But then, okay. But the dove at the end ties it back into the biblical thing. Stupid. And then they get the dove. Okay,
understand. For Christmas. All he wants for Christmas, for those of you who might not know, is like a Christian Hanukkah.
Kind of. Not really, because you get like a lot of presents on Christmas.
Well, you don't on Hanukkah?
I mean, How many did you get? One present a night?
No.
So.
I don't want to talk about it.
Anyway, I feel like it's more like it's more like
what Christmas is.
Because it's not like Hanukkah, and I refuse to accept that. I feel like it's more. I mean, it's kind of like a cross between Sukkot and Purim, because like you get like Mishloach Manot. But
Purim is just Jewish Halloween, which is coming up next week with our movie of choice.
Yeah. Yes. we'll tease that later. No, because Sukkot is the Jewish Halloween, because I learned recently that there's such a thing as sukkah hopping, where
you never been sukkah hopping?
Of course I've never been sukkah hopping. Bro. I grew up literally, Shoshana, there was one other Jewish person in my class growing up. Like, I went to religious school. I never built a sukkah until last year.
Okay.
In case you didn't know by now, I'm totally unqualified to do this podcast. I have never read all of the Parshiot. Like, this is my first time doing anything like this.
My memes. Anyway, sukkah hopping is so much fun. And, like, we used to do it with youth group, where you would start off at, like, one person's house. And, like, they found all of the loopholes. But you'd have, like, entree at one person's house and make kiddush and have entree. And then you'd go to the next person's house for the main course. And then you go to the next person's house for dessert.
Like a progressive dinner.
It's amazing.
I wanted to do that for Shavuot, because you have to be up all night. And so I was like, that could be fun. Like, you start at one person's house, then another, and, like, you do, like, different learning at each place. And there's, like, a snack, whatever. Fun. It didn't happen. But anyway, but sukkah hopping is more like trick-or-treating. Like, Mishloach Manot, I feel like, is more like Christmas presents.
Interesting. Anyway, so all this kid wants for Christmas is, he's like, I want a white dove, because all magicians have white doves. And it's like, shut up. Okay, why do you want your parents, like, that bird's gonna die. It's not a good pet. I don't know why he wants a white dove for his birthday. And then for Christmas,
they're literally pigeons. Pigeons.
Yeah, for Christmas, he gets a white dove.
In a beautiful bird cage. I would kill for that bird cage.
Oh my god, it's crazy. And everyone's so fine with it. I'm like, shit, no one wants, no dying woman needs a bird in her house. And she's just trying to die in peace.
Well, also, do you think that golden retriever will, like, hunt the dove?
Oh, my God. It's a horrible. Oh, man.
Like, isn't that what they're trained to do? It's so retrieve stupid. Doves?
It's so stupid.
Or not pigeons?
Dove
or
retriever.
Birds?
That's why it's called a golden retriever.
Because it retrieves gold. Yeah. Insert joke here.
I'm thinking about how dove.
Okay, so they get this dove. This was the point I'm trying to make you took this off. Before we talked about it.
Well, you were like, they got a dove and no one's seen this movie.
So they get this white dove. He gets it for anyway. And then at the very end, they like take a little family photo of the four of them. And then she's like, oh, come be in the photo. And it's an olive branch.
Oh, cute. That's nice.
Aww.
Aww. Too bad last week's Parsha dealt with both those things.
Literally everything I've said has had to do with another week's Parsha.
It's fine. It's all intertextuality.
Yeah.
Okay. Valerie Brown. Valerie Renee Brown.
Okay.
Wait,
Valerie... what, so your middle name is redacted, but mine is just out there?
Valerie Devorah Brucha Brown. Who are you casting for this week's part? I think we should cast Hagar, Sarai, a slightly younger Avram.
Okay. How about, like, Jake Gyllenhaal for Avram?
Okay, she's thinking... She's got a thinking cap on. Who in the hell put the muffin in the freezer?
Okay, so Ryan Hagar. I think that... what about Sydney Sweeney for Hagar?
Oh, interesting.
What about... what's her last name? Sophia Vergara?
Vergara,
yeah.
From Modern Family. That's interesting. That's an interesting choice.
I feel like she and Jake Gyllenhaal would look good together.
That's a fair point.
And she's also beautiful and sexy.
Okay. And
yeah, I think that's what I'm... imagine that all those people... Sydney Sweeney.
Oh, Sydney Sweeney, right.
And imagine that all those people are the same age, because they're obviously not.
we're working in, like, a post-race, post-age world. Okay, I think... I don't know who for Avram. Okay, I'm going to have a cop-out and say Susan Sarandon for Sarai.
Okay.
Because I just think that she has that, like... strong matriarch, can be really pissed off, can be really bitchy when she needs to vibe.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
I think my Hagar is going to be Keira Knightley.
Nice.
I'm thinking, like, Atonement vibes, Keira Knightley, and I'm thinking, the Pride and Prejudice style chutzpah.
Okay.
Of Hagar, for Hagar.
Sweet.
And then men don't exist in my head, so I can't cast. I don't know who for the guy. No. Oh, what about Joaquin Phoenix?
Ooh, I like that.
Like a bit whacked. Like imagine, okay, I know we didn't do the first part of Lech Lecha, but imagine like Joaquin Phoenix is your husband and he's like a bit strung out, a bit weirdy, wacky. And
he's like, pretend you're my sister.
He's like, let's leave everything we've ever known and just go because God's told me to go somewhere. And you're like, what? Like, I think that's a good fit. I think he's got like that manic vibe that we don't ever see associated with Avram, even though objectively a lot of wacky, wacky stuff happens.
Oh, the craziest things happen in these next few parshiot.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it's like, Sarai, whatever, this is similar to what we talk about with Noah and his wife, but like Sarai is following Avram, who is like hearing the voice of God.
Yeah.
And is like, our offspring are going to be numerous. Like, they have no way of knowing. Yeah. The only proof that they have is that Sarai is obviously barren, and then she has Yitzhak, and she's like, how old?
She's a million. 90?
I don't know. There's 90. A way of finding this out, but I'm
pretty sure she's 90. Next week, Valerie, I'll give you the distinct pleasure of introducing the text for Parshat Vayera.
So next week for Vayera, we are going to be watching Hocus Pocus.
We're not just watching Hocus Pocus. We have the very big task of convincing you that Hocus Pocus is based off of Parshat Vayera.
Another movie from 1998, I think, isn't Hocus Pocus?
93.
Oh, 93.
Yeah.
Okay, solidly in the 90s, though. But there is a sequel coming next year.
Yes, it's very timely. Time of year.
Yeah. Spooky season.
Spooky, scary skeletons.
Yeah.
Awesome. Alrighty. Thanks for listening. I hope you've made it halfway through this, at least. Okay, bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.